This is the Get Healthy 360 podcast, where we discuss topics related to your physical, mental, psychological, and spiritual health. Your host is Dr. Chris Ferguson, board certified in anesthesiology and pain management. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and you should consult your primary healthcare provider before making any decisions related to your health. And here's your host, Dr. Chris Ferguson.
Oh, one more thing before we start. If you like this episode, please consider rating us 5 stars. We would really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Welcome to Get Healthy 360. We have with us esteemed physician, Dr. Leonardo Caprell, MD, PhD. He's here for a return visit. Before, he talked about abdominal pain. Today, he'll be talking about pelvic pain, which is a complicated concept. For those of you who don't know, he's a pain physician at the Carolinas Pain Institute and Center for Clinical Research. He's also a professor of anesthesiology at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. His interests include peripheral nerve stimulation, spinal cord stimulation, discogenic back pain, visceral abdominal pain. He's the member of numerous societies. In addition, he's often an invited speaker to speak at many national and international meetings. He is a director at large at the American Academy of Pain Medicine and currently a director at large of both the North American and International Neuromodulation Society. Dr. Caprell, he's also written a phenomenal textbook on abdominal pain. I would highly recommend getting it. A lot of the things we're going to be discussing in this are really more geared to the pain specialist. So even among specialists, he's a specialist. So without further ado, Dr. Caprell, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Chris, for having me.
So we'll dive right in. You have the floor. When someone comes in with pelvic pain, and for anyone who's listening, pelvic pain is one of those scary things. Several years ago, I don't think there was as much to offer, or at least the information wasn't as commonly out there. And I would say even now, even amongst pain specialists, it's not frequently a pain condition that people would think a pain physician would treat. However, thanks to Dr. Caprell, a lot of doors are opening to give much needed relief to these patients. So Dr. Caprell, where would you like to start?
Well, I mean, Chris, there are expectations, you know, also from our colleagues, mainly GYN and urology colleagues to help in management of those patients, you know. I had a fortune and privilege to speak in several of their meetings, especially SUFU meetings, several times, and I was surprised how much questions and answers came after the session, and how much they are interested in what happened to these patients and how to diagnose the source of their pain if they are unable to do that using all kinds of imaging and other diagnostic tests. So we do have a tools. And that's a good thing. Any interventional pain physician, whichever specialty you're coming from, you do have tools in your hands, including diagnostic blocks and certain types of injections that we do that can actually direct us and tell first about the source of the pain and then help to control the pain over an extended time period. There was always a stigma about the chronic pelvic pain that it should be there because most of the chronic pelvic pains actually can be helped with. Yes. So we had a sort of like a informal group around the WIP and then also the INS. And I have to mention.
For anyone that doesn't know, WIP is the World Institute of Pain.
Institute of Pain and International Neuromodulation Society. So I just have to mention Jose de Andres from Spain and a couple of others that helped out sort of to establish this algorithm for the treatment of pelvic pain. I would say we went a long way. We got to the point where we can discuss step-by-step approach when it comes to two possible different sources of chronic pelvic pain. The one is obviously pelvic floor, which is relatively frequent and involves the pelvic floor issues in pudendal neuralgia and anterior wall of the bladder, while the other one is clearly visceral source of the pelvic pain. Just think about your patients after hysterectomy or with a certain pelvic procedures or ovarian cyst and chronic adhesions inside the pelvis, long-term chronic pain after certain reconstructive procedures. Lots of those carry a certain visceral source of the pain. But also you have to keep in mind that there is a crossover. And believe it or not, the crossover can be more frequent than we think of. So that's why some of us make a crucial mistake labeling the patient as non-responsive. I'll give you an example. In endometriosis, for example, there is in remission. The pelvic pain of the visceral source is almost always present. But 30-something percent of these patients do have also attachment to the pelvic floor. So they also have pudendal neuralgia, and they have to be treated by using both pathways that I would suggest tonight and that we established over the years. So there is a crossover in a certain problems, but most of the patients go along certain algorithms that we're going to talk about this evening.
So as a quick summary, so there's two pathways. There's the pelvic floor pathway, and then there's the visceral pathway. However, right. What you're saying is often there's crossover, but because people don't necessarily read the textbooks, so sometimes there's crossover, but typically you can think of it as these two different pathways, as the pelvic floor and then the visceral pelvic pain.
Exactly. We do also tend to mention a third pathway, which includes pelvic abdominal wall. I mentioned this pathway before when we were talking about abdominal pain. It's just a little bit lower down, mainly ilioinguinal genitofemoral neuralgia, iliohypogastric neuralgia. Those are sort of frequent causes of the pelvic or abdominal wall pain. But let's disregard this for just a moment and discuss these two pathways first, because most of the patients that we see, especially with unexplained causes of pelvic pain, belong to these two groups.
So when someone comes in and you have to do a history and physical exam, what are some of the key points you're looking for to try to differentiate between the visceral pain or that deep pain versus the pelvic floor pain?
That's the key question. Of course, you try to get some ideas about the source of the pain from the history. You know, is the pain worse with the sitting, positioning, standing? Is it, or is worse with, let's say, intercourse? Is it worse when the patient has certain bowel movement? Is it maybe burning type of the pain, or is deep and aching type of the pain? All of those characteristics needs to be put in place. Some of the key questions also that I mentioned before involve any of other previous non-invasive approaches that took place, like a physical therapy of the pelvic floor. If it was exquisitely painful, we always tend to believe that this is a pelvic floor issue or maybe pudendal neuralgia. So certain things that we can gather together from what was done before, or for example, if the GYN specialist already injected the pelvic floor and there was temporary relief of the pain, we know that it's probably coming from pelvic floor or pudendal neuralgia itself.
So to help clarify this, so there's the textbook definition of the difference between pelvic floor and visceral pain. However, in the real world, people come in and sometimes they just say everything hurts, and it's sure. Difficult for them to really clarify. Are there any key points that you really try to hone in on to differentiate or tease out the difference between pelvic floor pain and visceral pain?
Sure. As I said, the key points are if it's if there is a dyspareunia, if there is a pain with intercourse or pelvic floor physical therapy, those will more be aligned with endo neuralgia. And then if it's coming with the other sort of mainly related to peeing, going to the bathroom and stuff like that, will be more directed toward the possible visceral source. It's still very, very unclear from these definitions, but this plus physical exam plus diagnostic blocks will give us much clearer picture of on where the pain is coming from.
So if it's okay with you, what if we focused first on the pelvic floor? So sure. If you're thinking it's the pelvic floor, what's your workup?
Again, the physical exam, many of the patients will defer physical exam, and you may not need to do a vaginal exam because of it is exquisitely painful in those patients and has been done probably like a dozen times by, you know, GYN specialist and neurologist. So my focus when somebody comes with pelvic pain is to decide if you're going to go forward with pudendal nerve block. And most of the time, that's what we're going to do. If there is unclear or mixed source, then differential retrograde epidural block can be done. And that pain, that block can tell us a little bit about if there is more somatosensory pain versus visceral pain.
And for those who don't know, what is a differential retrograde block?
So differential retrograde epidural block has been established as a decent source of information to differentiate between visceral versus somatosensory versus central or psychogenic source of abdominal or pelvic pain. More of it, my colleague Salim Hayek wrote in that book that you mentioned before in beautifully written chapter, but he also suggested the steps and how to complete the block when it comes to pelvic or abdominal pain. It consists of placement of the epidural catheter in the back and then using first and second placebo to possibly eliminate placebo responders and all those who have secondary gain and so on. And then what we do, we inject fast onset, fast offset local anesthetic, mainly 2% ricroprocaine or maybe 2% lidocaine. For pelvic pain, we usually go either retrograde L5-S1, and we will place a certain amount local anesthetic until we get T10 or 11 level bilaterally sensory and sympathetic. At that time,
There, I know there are pain doctors that will be listening to this that will want to ask the question.
Yes.
Can you do a placebo block?
Yes, that's already in consent that you get from the patient. It's clearly stated that because of the accuracy and diagnostic nature of the block, we would at some point of time use placebo, and all of the patients are good with that.
It's covered by insurance, because that will be the next question people will ask.
Yeah, the differential block is covered as the epidural catheter placement, so it's it doesn't cover you for your time that you spend with the patient, though. But because it's such a great diagnostic assessment, mm-hmm. we think that it's worthwhile all of your time.
And again, I'll just mention the book. So again, the name of the textbook where all these steps are outlined, it's Chronic Abdominal Pain, an Evidence-Based Comprehensive Guide to Clinical Management, the 2015 edition.
Yes. That I think that was the, Comprehensive Treatment of Abdominal Pain, yeah.
So you do the differential block, and then what would be the next step?
Yeah, so basically, if the if when you inject the local anesthetic, if the pain goes away, so from about 8 to 0, then you leave the patient alone to retrograde part of the block. If the pain comes back with the sensorium, we consider this somatosensory pain. And most of the time when it comes to the pelvic pain patients, this is pudendal neuralgia, pelvic floor issue. And if the pain does not come back or comes back many hours later, then it's considered visceral. Mm-hmm. So that distinction can be made. However, also, if the pain doesn't go away and you have a complete sensory and sympathetic level bilaterally, then the question is if it's centralized or is psychogenic or is, you know, or is secondary gain. Those issues need to be explored. But anyway, those patients are not then candidates for your blocks that you would try in periphery. Mm-hmm. So we can have some idea. However, we don't really go after differential block in initial algorithm unless we are not sure or we don't have certain guide, some hint, if this pain is coming from abdominal, from pelvic floor, or it's coming from inside the pelvis. So if we do have a hint, we would rather go to diagnostic pudendal block for those who possibly have pelvic floor issues. So pudendal block will be first, and then we used to consider pulsed RF or even cryoablation of pudendal nerves, and some surgeons even neurotomies. But the problem with pulse RF is that we were unable to achieve a longer relief of the pain that we would achieve with just the pudendal nerve block. So we did a study in about 40-something patients, and there was no significant difference in time interval when it comes to block versus a pulse radio frequency ablation. To do real ablation, temperature, high temperature based is a problem because of that third branch that supplies the sphincter of urethra. So and then as far as the neurotomies, I'm not going to go into it. It has been evaluated and lots of letters and negative assessments were made in surgical literature. So I don't think that's a good step to take. As far as the novel therapies, if you have a positive response, if the patient does have a positive response to pudendal nerve block, then S2, S3 transforaminal injections can be tried. And I have been trialing this now for several years in a good group of the patients because the dorsal root ganglia of the S2 and S3 are the ones who help to compose pudendal nerves on each side. So what we do in certain group of the patients, transforaminal injection of local anesthetics and steroids, and we get some prolonged relief of the pain. In subgroup of the patients, there is not that large, but still significant in order to proceed with repeated transforaminal injections over an extended time period. And then the third and next step will be neuromodulation. Now, when we're talking about pudendal neuralgia, the newer therapies like the dorsal root ganglia stimulation have been evaluated in a small series. We presented those data last year. Corey Hunter from New York did a nice case series, and those were published. So stimulating again DRGs of the S2 and S3 makes all sense when it comes to severe pudendal neuralgia. Now, other considerations are peripheral nerve stimulation, and some of this work was completed by several really great urologists who were placing differently designed peripheral leads to the pudendal nerves and Alco's canal, I want to mention Peters up in Detroit. He did so much of the work related to this. And those are successful, although the problem is always that the canal itself and surrounding area contains mussels, and it's the stability of the lead is always in question. So this will be the algorithm for pudendal neuralgia and pelvic floor issues.
So a question that you alluded to it, and what I think a lot of people would be interested in is, could you discuss the efficacy of the transpyramidals versus, say, doing a DRG? And also the second part of that question is, how predictive are transpyramidals to predict the efficacy of a DRG stimulator?
This is current work in progress. Actually, we're just working on it right now. We don't have a good data. Okay, so
I know that there's not a lot of good data. If you want to pass on the question, that's fine. But
I can give you one answer that it seems that we have a high predictive value of the S2 S3 transforaminas to predict who's going to have a positive response to dorsal ganglia stimulation. But only a few centers are trialing the transforaminal S2 S3 injections right now, and hopefully we're going to have more in order to be able to talk about the long-term efficacy in a larger group of the patients. You know, the small case series are good as initial information to say something like that can be done, but also can be misleading, you know, because you don't have a large cohorts of the patients to say, well, this is efficacious or this is highly efficacious. It's really unfair to say that. And we are at this stage right now where I cannot say if it's highly efficacious. I know that it works, and I know that it works for quite a few months, much longer than any transforaminals that we do for back and leg pain, mainly for lumbar sacral radiculopathy. But about longevity and efficacy in a large group of the patients who suffer from any kind of neuritis versus classic neuralgia versus direct damage to the pudendal nerve, I cannot comment on it right now.
So the other question I know that people want me to ask is, DRG has been shown to be highly efficacious for a variety of nerve conditions where typical dorsal column stimulation doesn't work quite as well. However, there is some thought about lateral stimulation placement where you put the lead just a little bit more lateral to cover the dorsal horn. And other people also want me to ask what your thoughts are on retrograde placement of the spinal cord stimulator lead.
Oh yeah, all of those apply. You know, last 20 years before we taught about DRG stimulation, we used anterograde and retrograde placement of the classical 8-contact or 4-contact leads that we use for spinal cord stimulation. However, let me go first to your first question to make a comment. We are talking about S2, S3 stimulation. So now you are in the area where you are at the spread caudal equina in epidural space, sacral literary retrograde placement, because you need to get to the DRG. Now imagine where the DRG of S2 and where the DRG of S3 is positioned. It's actually in epidural space, but much more proximal from the actual foraminal opening. So you have to go up there and literally go toward the midline in order to get the proper stimulation. You don't have, you're way past, the dorsal columns. So you are at periphery, but you can easily reach the DRG just by simply leveling the introducer to the sacral epidural space and pushing that lead proximally in sort of anterograde fashion from the foramina up toward the epidural space. And that has been done, and those pictures are all over the place, and you can see Corey's publication, but also you can see some of our data as well, and it seems to be successful. When it comes to anterograde and retrograde stimulation, I would say probably some of the folks like Jose de Andres from Spain, they have the most experience in the world. And it seems that stability of the anterograde placement from hiatus going all the way down, like you would place the caudal injection, seems to be pretty consistent. Now, when you implant, you have to kind of move the butt a little bit on the side and do a very interesting sort of horizontal incision so you are able to place that electrode properly. But it seems to be working better than our retrograde approach that we used to do 10 or 15 years ago.
So just to clarify for what you're saying, for anyone who missed it, so what you're saying is there are other physicians that, and correct me if I'm misspeaking, but there are other physicians that are going through that sacral canal anterograde, meaning you're going superior, and then anchoring it in that buttock region.
Exactly. So you can try. So if you are using classical 8 contact leads, you can go retrograde from the L4-5 or even from L5-S1 and going down toward the S2 and S3 foramina. Okay. You can also go upward in epidural space from the old way using a caudal approach and the placing the lead that way, anchoring it relatively low. In the buttock. However, that approach seems to be relatively stable, so the lead doesn't go left and right. You know, instability of those leads are sort of major issue why we haven't been doing that many of these procedures over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And then when the DRG stimulation came along, it made all sense because first of all, those tiny leads seems to be very stable when you push them backwards from the foramina, and also you get really nicely exactly next to the dorsal root ganglia. So the location wise and the stability of the leads allowed you to achieve long term stimulation in those patients.
I'm going to ask a question, and if you want to pass on this question, or if there's not enough data, then that's fine. Say you had a patient and you had to pick the anterograde caudal approach with a traditional 8 lead contact versus DRG. Which one would you use?
I use exclusively DRG now. And because I don't see, I think from the standpoint of efficacy and stability, and this could be my bias because we don't have comparison study to support that. But based on quite a few of us who trialed that, that would be the way to go. And we are now talking only about pelvic floor and pudendal neuralgia. Mm-hmm. When we talk about visceral pain, stimulation at the conus or just above the conus seems to be the most efficacious.
DRG?
Nope, just the dorsal column stimulation.
Place that in the midline or more lateral?
That's midline. If you look at the data, there is ID that was filed with the FDA, and the study was completed in Atlanta. This is a colleague of ours who did a phenomenal job, Dr. Tate, using 10 kilohertz stimulation. She went up to T11 in order to provide, and this is dorsal column stimulation at T11 level, and she was able to achieve profound relief, but this is visceral hyperalgesia. These are the patients who are post-hysterectomy patients, remission of endometriosis with a clearly visceral source of the pain responsive to superior hypogastric plexus block. This is that other arm that I was just about to discuss.
So any closing thoughts or any last thoughts on the pelvic floor pain, and then we can move, or should we move on to the visceral pain?
Again, detailed questions about the characteristics of the pain, the type of the pain, mainly is neuralgia type of the pain. As I mentioned before, pelvic floor physical therapy is extremely painful. Intercourse is painful. Any kind of exam, the pudendal nerve block is efficacious short term. Again, consider S2, S3 transforaminal injections. Consider DRG stimulation. That's probably now the best that we can offer.
Fantastic. That was a great summary. So moving on then, if you're okay with it, to the visceral pain.
Sure. And again, different characteristic of the pain. There's nothing at abdominal wall that you can, you know, it doesn't get worse with activity. Most of the time doesn't get worse with intercourse. It gets worse with the bowel movement. It gets worse with the menstrual cycles. And in many patients, it's post-surgical. In many patients, comes along as the consequence of long-standing endometriosis. Post-hysterectomy patients, quite a few of them will have this type of the visceral hyperalgesia. And, which is quite remarkable, most of them respond to superior hypogastric plexus block, at least short term.
So you have a patient that, based on the history, physical exam, you're suspecting visceral pain. So your first step typically is the superior hypogastric nerve block.
Exactly. Bilateral superior hypogastric plexus block seems to be the best first step in treatment of these patients.
So let's
keep in mind they don't have trigger points on their belly, so they don't have any possible source. They may have referral, but you know, the Kanet sign, any palpation on the belly does not reproduces significant trigger points.
And for anyone who's listening, what's the Kanet sign?
Oh, Kanet sign is something that has been used in gastroenterology for a long time. Basically, what patient does, raises both of the legs, tries to basically engage the rectus abdominis muscle, and if the pain happens, pain worsens, then the thinking is in GI community that the pain is coming from abdominal wall. However, the sensitivity and specificity of the Kanet sign is relatively low.
And if anyone wants to look that up or look for more information, correct me if I'm wrong, but the spelling is Karnett sign.
Exactly. Correct.
So the Kanet sign is negative. You do the superior hypogastric plexus block. And what are there are three options. Either you get equivocal, a little bit of relief, not 100% relief. You get 100% relief, or you get no relief. What would you do in those three different pathways?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. If somebody responds very well to superior hypogastric plexus block, depends on the longevity of the pain relief, I would definitely decide to move on with the anterograde regular spinal cord stimulation. And based on the data that we have right now, probably 10 kilohertz seems to have the best response. Keep in mind there are new types of therapies that are developing that have comparable success rate for back and leg pain, and I'm not going to discuss those today. But some of the data that we got from the IDE study suggests that that those patients who achieve more than 50% of the pain relief when it comes to anterograde stimulation at this T10 T11 level that Dr. Tate presented to us this year at the NANS meeting exceeds 80%. So that's very impressive and definitely is a good starting point for future randomized prospective study. I would say probably that will be my next step in the treatment of those patients. So if they have positive response with more than 50% of the pain relief from superior hypogastric plexus block, then I would go on and stimulate.
So I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I just want to finish your question.
Okay.
Then you said, well, if it's a partial response, I mentioned before that some of the patients with extensive adhesions, either these are post-surgical, reconstructive surgeries, or endometriosis, they may have combination of two, pelvic floor involvement with a visceral source. So in that case, you really need to do both. You need to do superior hypogastric plexus block, and you need to do pudendal nerve block and measure or assess from where the most of the pain is coming from. and then decide which way to go. Still, if you think about long-term therapy in the patients who have sort of 50-50, you know, pain coming from pelvic floor and pain coming from inside the viscera, I would definitely go after anterograde spinal cord stimulation. In that case, we seems to be are doing very well to control both. Those who do not respond, and that was your another assumption, those who do not respond, I would go and do pudendal block to see if the pain is coming from pelvic floor and or do differential retrograde epidural nerve block to assess the source of the pain.
Now, I think you also mentioned you have the bestopiniondoctor.com website.
Yes. So we have a website. Thank you for mentioning that. We have a website which is also named Chronic Pain Research Institute. We assembled decent groups. Now, I think we are more than 20, and we are ever expanding of the key opinion leaders across the world. Lots of them are from US, but also from Australia, Europe, and South America right now. And what we decided to do is to provide in difficult patients, like patients that we are discussing today, another opinion, maybe adding more to the algorithm of the treatment of such a pain. Give you an example, all of us, and me and you, had the patient that doesn't respond to anything. And we try this and we try that. And so in order to add to it or to provide another opinion, we thought that will be useful to initiate that website. The patients can log in. They can upload their, in very, very simple fashion, they can upload their data. And within a few days, they would receive their questions answered. I think it's useful because it will also maybe help with our colleagues, you know, who end up in conundrum of the various types of complicated pelvic and abdominal pains, to have such a basically group of the physicians, different specialties, they can add to the therapy of some of the complicated patients.
So, and the reason I bring this up is I'm aware that, and I know you mentioned for the spinal cord stimulation, that at this time you would recommend the 10K stimulation frequency. Now, I personally have had patients who, from say a given doctor would try a different spinal cord stimulator, it wouldn't work. Those patients would not do well, and they would think there was nothing else. I would see those patients for a second opinion, and then actually I tried the 10K, and it went from 0% pain relief to 100% pain relief. And this was a few years ago, and this patient is still experiencing 100% pain relief. So do you want to comment a little bit on, even though a given doctor can do everything appropriately, sometimes very subtle differences like brand of stimulator or placement can actually make a very large difference.
I mean, listen, objectively, if you look at the data, and data are very clear, you know, you have now three types of therapies that we tend to believe that finally exceeds 80% of the patients with more than 50% of the pain relief. So it's not only 10K, but it's also closed loop stimulation and something that is called glial cell or DTM type of stimulation that was initiated by the work of Ricardo Vallejo. So those therapies definitely provide better relief of the pain. And in some of the patients that really did not respond to traditional stimulation, when you switch to those more advanced type of therapies, I would say more advanced type of the waveforms, the patients respond. I mean, we have now a study that we just completed with the University of Kansas with Dr. Sayed, who is a good friend and partner in crime in many of these studies in the past. We have over 150 patients that we switched from traditional spinal cord stimulation to 10 kilohertz. And most of them responded better than we expected. But who knows tomorrow what kind of other waveforms we're going to have that may provide similar or better improvements in the pain scores. So I can't, you know, comment on it, but as I said, now if you look at the RCTs, level one evidence, There are three of those therapies that provide such a profound relief of the pain, and hopefully we'll have a couple of more in the next 2 or 3 years.
Can you give just a little bit of background about the two? So there's the 10 can, and you mentioned two other therapies. Can you just give a little bit of background on what those therapies are?
It wasn't intended to be a spine crystal, but I can talk a little bit
just
about
briefly.
It. So we just published the closed loop data. This is the idea. This is really great idea where we use ECAPs. We actually stimulate and get response from the dorsal columns over the same lead with 8 contacts. So we stimulate from one electrode and we record to another ECAPs that lead us to get to certain therapeutic range based on what we can see as a response in sensory response from the dorsal columns. I'm really happy to report that in our large study that was published in Lancet Neurology in December of 2019, improvements in the pain scores when it comes to closed loop type of stimulation exceeded 80% of the patients with more than 50% of the pain relief. So that's one of the therapies. The other one is a great work of a friend of mine, Ricardo Vallejo, who started something which is called Stimgenics. And this is now part of Medtronic. But he brought up this issue that we could possibly inhibit with a certain type of electrical stimulation of dorsal columns, several types of glial cells. That includes microglials and astrocytes. And if we are able to do that, we may get additional effect in addition to stimulating dorsal columns at the same time. And he was absolutely right. If you look at the basic science, long-term data based on, the basic science studies, and he has now a dozen of these studies that he did over the last 10 years. And then first RCT, randomized prospective trial, again, DTM provided more than 50% of the pain relief in more than 80% of the patients. So as I said, this is now, we call this 80% club as opposed to 50% club that we had for many, many years. So I think that tells a little bit about where this whole story about spinal cord stimulation is heading. And I tend to believe there will be a few more of these therapies coming over the next couple of years that may match this 80% result or even better. We'll see that.
And this is not a really meant to be a conversation about spinal cord stimulators, but the other thing you have on this pathway for the visceral pelvic pain is superior hypogastric neurolysis. Can you comment on that technique and when would you use it?
Well, I mean, listen, I use superior hypogastric plexus blocks using local anesthetic. Consideration can be made to use phenol, but keep in mind you are close to very sensitive structures, okay? My concern will always be that will be some neural damage because it's very hard to control spread of the neurolytic substances, you know. I know for the fact that there are case series done across the country, including my own at that time Cleveland Clinic, that provided long-term benefit in those patients using 10% phenol. However, I haven't used that. I don't recommend it. I'm not sure if any of these patients will end up with more serious complications. Again, we don't have data to support that.
And that makes a lot of sense. Any closing thoughts on either visceral pain or pelvic pain or anything that you think that people should be aware of or know about?
Well, I mean, I just want to mention that stigma, you know, that when these patients go through GYN and urology evaluation, and they cannot find the source of the pain. Lots of them are women, are being labeled, and then they come to us. And you will be surprised how many of them will respond when you apply such an algorithm. You will be surprised how many of them will achieve long-term profound relief of the pain. And so it's a great mistake to label those patients by, you know, psychogenic or centralized pains before we do not apply those algorithms and try to treat them that way.
And again, so can you name some of the common conditions, just to summarize, that you've seen for pelvic pain that people typically would inappropriately label someone as psychogenic or a little bit crazy, but actually you've seen significant success with these conditions?
I would tell you number one is definitely interstitial cystitis, you know. And if you look at the, because of the complexity of the bladder innervation, and because both S2 and S3 fibers from the front and the visceral fibers from the back supply the bladder. The other one is the pudendal neuralgia. Lots of patients with pudendal neuralgia are being labeled as, I don't know, let's say crazy or whichever way you want to. But then when you apply decent ultrasound-guided or fluoroscopy-guided blocks and later on neuromodulation, those patients are extremely responsive. Post-hysterectomy pain, I would say 20 to 25% of the patients, depending which paper you read, will have some chronic pain after hysterectomy. So post-surgical pain is very frequent in the pelvic area and needs to be addressed. And usually it has been in the past dismissed by most of the surgeons. That's where you get in, provide the proper assessment, apply these algorithms, and hopefully give them long-term relief of the pain.
Thank you so much for taking the time for this podcast, and also all the research and publications that you do. I think that the team of physicians that you work with, as you said, you work with physicians all over the world, are bringing forth really much needed therapies for typically very hard areas to treat, which is pelvic pain. And then we have our other podcast that we did on abdominal pain, which I would also encourage people to listen to. To recap, you have the website bestopiniondoctor.com. So patients can submit their cases to be reviewed. And from what you told me, it was relatively affordable. How much was it?
Yeah, so I think it's, to be honest with you, it's about $500 probably for the whole consult, whole thing. I'm not even sure. I have to check, but somewhere in that range, let's say $400 or $500.
Which is the cost of an hour of a lawyer, probably. So I think
evaluation,
that's,
yeah,
given the level of care and consideration someone's getting, that seems very reasonable. And then I also, again, to reiterate, you have the chronic pain textbook that I would recommend anyone getting, because it's definitely great reading. So Dr. Capra, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview.
Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a comment on the Get Healthy 360 Facebook page and consider subscribing to this podcast. Thanks.